cause number 132117 CV, Stand for Something Group Live, LLC DBA, The Rail Club Live et al. Versus Greg Abbott as Governor of Texas, Texas Alcoholic Beverage Commission, and the State of Texas.
Hey, please, the court. I'm assuming the court has the demonstrative that we sent in earlier.
Yes, and the clerk is going to give you the screen sharing opportunity. And we also, you know, have the PDF, so.
Oh, outstanding. Sometimes I don't know if we get to share the screen or not. So
yeah, we only ask that, of course, you know, you not put anything up there that's inappropriate, which we anticipate you would do.
No, ma'am. Okay. Let me just say that since we didn't file a reply brief in this case, I just want to reply to the appellee's brief real quick. The Attorney General has argued that this case is moot because the bars can be open now. But that's not the end of the story. Right now, as we speak, the TABC is trying to put my clients out of business because they violated these rules last year. That's happening right now. And we've alleged that's in the record. I didn't give a lot of details on it. I could give the details, but of course the court knows that it's supposed to be taking the allegations as they provide. There's been no contrary evidence or allegation that the TABC is not currently prosecuting my clients. And so it is clear.
They're trying to put them out of business. They're trying to deny them the license, or what is it that they're doing?
They're currently suspending and canceling the licenses, Your Honor.
Okay. Now, you did allege that in your brief. Okay.
We did. And we didn't give the details. In fact, right now we're in the process of writing a 29.3 rule for emergency order asking that all of those prosecutions end. It's not before the court today, but just as a heads up, that's coming. Because we just filed a motion for rehearing to try to stop that again and delay that game and try to get the court, the SOA court, to do that.
Are they doing this under the same provisions of the GA, which is the most recent one? I mean, under GA 32 than the previous order of which you've been complaining about, or the previous orders have been rescinded?
Yeah, it's a funny thing. They have these old orders, and then they've cited my clients under those orders, and then they're trying to cancel the liquor license of my clients under those orders and those citations, even though those orders are no longer, have been superseded by later orders. Okay. So it's clearly not moot, right? I mean, they're prosecuting my client under those old orders. It's kind of like saying, well, I only beat you up yesterday. I haven't beat you up today. No, you're still beating me up. Even under those orders, you're still beating me up. So,
counsel, what you're saying is that because they're contending that your client violated those orders when those orders were in place, that now they are prosecuting that or holding you all responsible for having violated those orders at the time they were still in effect? Is that essentially what is occurring?
That's exactly correct, Your Honor. So we have these ongoing, and of course, as the courts know, and as we've alleged and informed, the bar rules change periodically. And because mm-hmm. there's no legislative change, and because there's no stakeholder process, they simply say, well, it's an emergency, therefore we don't have to follow any of our emergency rules. We don't have to follow our normal rules. We don't have to follow even the rules to the extent that we can. The TABC has ongoing issues of all sorts. They're mundane operations, approving and canceling liquor licenses all the time. And our situation is, we're alleging, look, even if it's an emergency, you still have an obligation to provide stakeholder input whenever you can, to the extent that you can. This is not a flash flood that's going to happen tomorrow, right? This has been a long-standing event that's happened over a course of almost 2 years now. There's plenty of time to at least attempt to gather some stakeholder input and follow its own procedures to the extent that it can. It should not be, the Attorney General seems to take the position of, we're either in normal circumstances and we have this set of rules, or we're in emergency circumstances and we don't have to do anything. The reasoning by the Attorney General is that now we're in disaster land. we don't have to do anything. We can just do whatever we want. We can tell everybody that they, we can make changes however we feel like, and it doesn't have to be rational at all. They'll say that it has to be rational, and then they'll say, well, we use our imagination to show rationality. But even then, they're confusing the issues, if I might. And the court will see this on, I guess, page, let me see if I can do this.
I need to ask another question on the mootness. I understand your argument that you're still being prosecuted, but you've also argued that the executive orders are capable of repetition and are evading review. Of course, these briefs were filed late spring, if I recall correctly, maybe early summer. Since then, we have had, as you well know, a resurgence, the Delta variant, you know, increased hospitalizations, deaths, and yet we did not see, you know, the any new orders in place. In fact, the governor seems to be less restrictive by not doing vaccine mandates and not doing mask mandates, in fact, banning them. Is that something that this court can take into consideration when analyzing that argument?
I think the court's, there's nothing wrong with court seeing reality, right? And so political considerations have impacted the governor and his decision-making, as they always have, and that's he's the governor, right? Our issue is that the rules have to be rational, whatever they are. And all of these rules within the Texas code says they can be challenged in a judicial court where we are. So the issue today is whether or not this court, the trial court, has jurisdiction. And we're not trying to win on the merits today. We're just trying to say, right, challenge this, right? So I think that certainly the court can observe that these rules are impacted and thrown together in certain ways, and what the reality of the commission is today. I would never tell the court they should not take judicial notice of the current landscape. But we would go back and say that if it gets bad enough, of course the governor is going to do something different. And we're not, again, we did, and as I also have to say, in all of these cases, nobody filed this case a month into this, right? You know, we didn't know if this was zombie apocalypse or what. We really didn't have any idea a year and a half ago what was going on. It's only after you start seeing the irrational nature of the regulations. And we haven't said that there's no rational basis or that to distinguish between a restaurant area and a bar area. Our issue has been that the rules say that a bar area, standalone bar, and I always like to picture a refurbished gas station, you know, a small bar on the corner of a shop, an acre, you know, it's just a small area. The issue is whether or not the TABC can say that area is so dangerous that no matter what, it has to be closed. At the same time, if I take that area, and you see that on the three slides in the demonstrative, if I take that same area and I put it inside a Chili's, we're not saying that the Chili's couldn't be open. If the TABC had wanted to say all bar areas must be closed, that would be at least arguable. But when it says standalone bars must be closed unless it's inside a Chili's, I think that's irrational. And then we add the
how do you distinguish the big time investments case out of the Fifth Circuit?
I did that. The big time investment case, I have done that.
Yeah, it was an equal protection claim that they were reviewing there. And of course, they talked about the standard. And then they did distinguish between the types of bars and restaurants. Very similar. There are some differences in this case, of course, but that one.
And that's where we would go. In the big time investments case, there's no discussion of, you know, we use the word bar to see bar area, but we say that very clearly in our pleadings. It's a bar area. And so there's no rational base. Big time doesn't talk about a bar area inside a Chili's versus a bar area. They just closed all bars and then they allowed all restaurants. In our case, you have the added salt on the wound of saying, well, if you pretend that you're a restaurant, we put a food truck in your parking lot, and then we can pretend that that makes it safe. And I would say that's where I think you're completely off your rockers. And no reasonable person would say that the bar area is made safe by putting a food truck in the parking lot. Because now you got people walking around. You got the worst of both worlds, right? You've got a restaurant area and you got people walking around. I don't know how anybody can say if you were, and this is what's happening. The TABC is citing people for unsafe operations. In no way can any rash, I don't see it. And I think I've got a pretty good imagination. How is a dangerous bar made more safe by putting a food truck in the parking lot and telling people going back and forth with tacos?
Warren, your first 10 minutes are up. Unfortunately, would you like to continue or wait until your rebuttal?
No, I'm perfectly fine. I didn't file the reply brief because I think that we briefed this fairly well. I'm happy to answer any questions when the opposing counsel is there.
Okay, let's go ahead and then hear from Mr. Dower, and then you'll have your remaining 10.
Well then, may it please the court. This court should affirm the trial court's order holding that it lacked jurisdiction over the plaintiff's claim for two reasons. First, the claims that seek only declaratory and injunctive relief are moot, and I'll talk about that in detail in a moment. And then second, sovereign immunity bars the claims in their entirety, including the claim seeking compensatory damages, which is the takings claim. So to hone in on mootness and respond directly to Mr. Norrod's comment, there's only one. Well, yesterday I went and met with my client to inquire about, are there anything outstanding with regards to the, I don't know, I can't remember, 19 plaintiffs thereabouts, to see, you know, how many or whether there's anything pending. And we went through each one. And to my knowledge, there's only one administrative enforcement action pending. And I would submit, first of all, to the court that none of this is in the record. So it's a little bit difficult for me here because I feel like I'm shadow boxing. I'm about to refer to a document, but it's not in the record. And so it's very difficult for me to respond. So first of all, I would just submit that if the argument is that it's not moot because of the allegation that TABC is and currently today engaged in some sort of administrative enforcement action, then that needs to be submitted to the court somehow, because the pleadings were back before the executive order that's being challenged here was rescinded. And so respectfully, I don't think that the allegation from the petition has any bearing on mootness for an executive order that was rescinded once this case was already up on appeal. But the one administrative action that I'm aware of that is ongoing, it's SOA docket number, if the court wants it, 458-21-0546. There is part of that administrative proceeding that talks about how the particular bar, this was Rail Club Live, the sort of the titular plaintiff in this case, was operating while their bar, their mixed beverage permit was suspended, but they were also charged with violating Texas Alcoholic Beverage Code Section 28.06C, which has nothing to do with any emergency suspensions, which prohibits that particular establishment from knowingly possess or permit to be possessed on licensed premises any alcoholic beverage which is not covered by an invoice from the supplier from whom the alcoholic beverage was purchased. And so, and again, none of this is in the record, which makes it a little bit hard to speak about. But what happened was Rail Club Live hosted a bring your own beer event, which their mixed beverage permit did not allow them to do. And it's actually mandatory revocation if a bar violates section 28.06C. And so in the proposal for decision, which again is not before the court, which makes this difficult, but in the proposal for decision, the administrative law judge found that the staff met its burden of proof and the TABC was required to cancel their permit. and that the permit must be canceled because they violated 28.06C, which has nothing to do with any issue in this case.
Well, Counselor, let me ask you this, but I assume that the Bring Your Own Beer event was when these orders were in place, because otherwise they wouldn't be having that event. They would be trying to sell their own beer. So I assume that it is somewhat related to the executive order issued by the governor, is it not?
I would respectfully disagree with that, Your Honor, because that provision that they violated is in place regardless of the circumstances. A bar that has a mixed beverage permit cannot do that even under normal times. And so it's not sufficient, I would submit, to give that plaintiff standing to challenge an executive order, because it has nothing to do, the violation of that section has nothing to do with the governor's executive orders.
Appellants have said that the appellees have not contradicted the testimony of appellants who are currently being prosecuted for operating contrary to GA 28. So whatever is in the record is what our review will be limited to. We can assure you that.
Okay, well then what I would say is disregard everything I just said, because it's not in the record. And I'll just submit that if you look at the deposition testimony, it's gonna be talking about things that were going on at that time, which were emergency suspensions, you know, circa December 2020, which is when that testimony occurred. That was when we had our temporary injunction hearing. And at that point, all that we would have been talking about were emergency suspensions, which are of course no longer in place. The longest of them lapsed after 90 days. And so if all the court looks at is in the record in this case, then I think our mootness argument is very, very, on very, very good footing. But I want to respond to the argument about capable of repetition yet evading review, because Chief Justice Contreras, you made an excellent point that I want to echo, which is that in order for capable of repetition yet evading review to apply, there has to be a reasonable expectation that the plaintiffs will be subjected to the same action again. And the mere physical or theoretical possibility that the complaining party may be subjected to the same action again is not sufficient to satisfy the test. And I would direct the court to a case that we cite in our brief, Trulock versus City of Duncanville, because in that case, the plaintiff was cited for violating a city ordinance. They brought a civil case challenging that ordinance. And then while the case was going on, the ordinance was amended and the things that they were convicted of violating were stripped out of the ordinance. And that happened while the case was on appeal. That was when it was amended. And so the court said in assessing the capable of repetition yet evading review exception, that there was no reasonable expectation that the plaintiff would be subjected to the same wrong again, because of course the ordinance that they'd been cited and they were challenging was no longer in effect. And the court in holding that acknowledged that, well, maybe they'd be cited for a different ordinance, but if that happened, then they could always, you know, file their lawsuit and seek a temporary injunction on this new ordinance. And so that would be just a different case.
Let me ask you this. Under your interpretation, wouldn't it be possible, obviously, I mean, you're basically saying that the governor does have the right to issue similar restrictions in the future, and whether he does or not is really a political issue or his personal decision. But the way you all are interpreting the statute, you're saying that, aren't you saying that the governor could do it again if things got really bad?
Could, Your Honor, but could is not the legal standard, respectfully. The legal standard is that a reasonable expectation exists that they'll be subject to the same action. And so possibility is not sufficient. You have to have reasonable expectation. And as Justice Contreras alluded to, right now, we just emerged from a peak. And so if you were going to have, you know, expect a governor to impose some sort of re-shut down another economic restriction, it would have been during the peak of the Delta virus. But instead, what we saw was executive orders that sort of went the opposite way, where they imposed limitations on local officials who wanted to impose more restrictions. And so in light of the fact that COVID is now going down, our hospitalization rates, thank goodness, are going down, new cases are going down, deaths are going down. And in light of the fact that when they were climbing and at their peak, there was nothing even remotely suggesting that the governor would impose the type of economic restrictions that he did back in 2020. I think that the standard of reasonable expectation has not been met. And while it's certainly possible, there is some theoretical possibility that there could be an epsilon or omega variant and there has to be new restrictions. That theoretical possibility is so abstract here that it is insufficient to meet the capable of repetition yet evading review. And I would also note that, if you think about the purpose of that, to prevent the defendants from revoking an executive order in order to evade judicial review, I mean, what the record shows is that this case was dismissed in December of 2020, and the executive order 32 that they were challenging wasn't amended or rescinded effectively, the terms that they're challenging here, until March. And so this is not a case where it looks like you've got a bad actor who's trying to evade judicial review. I didn't talk to Greg Abbott, but I would imagine that the rescission in March was because that's when vaccines were becoming available. And so he perceived that there was not the need. And so because there's nothing for this or the trial court to enjoin, I mean, you can't enjoin an executive order that's not in effect. And because a backwards looking declaration does not cure any current harm. Respectfully, all of the requests for injunctive and declaratory relief have become moot with the passage of time. And I would just note
let's assume that we disagree with you and that we proceed to review some of the claims here. I have a question regarding TABC's procedure under 11.614B. Was that done in this case? And if not, well, I guess this would be a better question for Mr. Nora that he can follow up on, because you say that the under the TABC, a business is entitled to a hearing with the State Office of Administrative Hearings, and then an ALJ can, make a decision on this emergency order. Is that something that was done in any of these cases?
Yes, Your Honor. It was. The way it worked was that the TABC had this statutory authority talking about continuing threat to public welfare. And so they utilized that statutory authority to enforce. Yeah. So I expect Mr. Norrod will say, I think there was maybe one or two occasions where the hearing wasn't set within 10 days. And so he may make an issue of that, but I think certainly overall, and with the exception of maybe a few cases that were a few days late, that this is certainly the procedure that they followed. And I think the lateness had to do with some ambiguity about whether the setting needed to be set within 10 days or whether the hearing needed to be within 10 days. But certainly TABC, in the vast majority of cases, not only endeavored to follow this statute, but did so with great consistency.
So how do you respond to their argument that the TABC's method was irrational? And the best example, of course, is the taco truck thing. I mean, I have to agree with Mr. Norris' argument that how does putting a taco truck in a parking lot now make a bar safer?
Well, Your Honor, I guess I have two responses to that. First, in order for this taco truck to resolve the situation, that they would have to sell enough tacos that the majority of the revenue was food, not alcohol. And at the point at which people have to order that much food, they're eating, they're less likely to be inebriated in that way. They're not hopping from bar to bar in the same way. So I do think there is some rationality, but I think the stronger point, which is echoed by the Fifth Circuit's opinion that Your Honor referenced earlier, is that rationality is not a high bar. When you're challenging the rationality, you have to negate every conceivable basis. And this is a direct quote, if the classification has some reasonable basis, it does not offend the Constitution simply because the classification is not made with mathematical nicety or because in practice it results in some inequality. And so what that argument really is it's an over and under inclusive argument. In other words, there's some bad actors that get away with it because of the way that the executive order is structured. And there's some good actors who, despite their good intentions, fall within its restrictions. But the fact that we can postulate some specific examples that don't really make sense doesn't make the law itself irrational. Because if you think about it, all line drawing has examples where you could argue, well, that's irrational. And I'll take one that I know is close to all of our hearts, which is voting. You know, what is it that's magic about 18? I mean, when you're 17 and 11 months and, you know, 29 days, you're not, you know, there's nothing that happens to your brain where it suddenly becomes civic minded on the day you turn 18. It's not like the Grinch where his heart grows three sizes that day. I mean, but nevertheless, we have this restriction because, of course, voting is basically binary. You're either allowed to do it or you're not allowed to do it. You can't like do a half vote. And so even with something as fundamental as the right to vote, nevertheless, we have to draw some sort of line somewhere. And it is rational to have adults able to participate in our civic engagement, in our civic discourse, and civic process through electing their representative officials. And it is rational to say adults can do that and children can't. And we have to draw a line somewhere. And so the fact that it is a line in the sand does not make it irrational. And the fact that I know some 17-year-olds that I would trust to vote more than other, you know, people in their 40s, again, not naming names, but that itself doesn't bring down voting restrictions. Or alcohol itself, 21. You turn 21, you're allowed to drink. If you're 20 and some months, you're not allowed to drink. And yet that is rational because there's some level of maturity that we think people should be required to have before they can, you know, drink an intoxicating substance. And so the rational basis here is, you know, if you think about bars, they tend to be, you know, crowded where you're trying to order at the bar rather than having wait staff come to you. People tend to go there to drink. And in fact, the whole definition of a bar is based on sales of alcohol. So you've got people that are more likely to be intoxicated. They're not eating food, which tends to slow the rate of intoxication. They tend to be noisy. And so noisy is shouting. Shouting is spittle. All these things are rational. They tend to be younger people, Your Honor, tend to go to bars. Again, this is a generalization, but young people are asymptomatic. So they don't know that they're sick. And so all of these things are rational. They're rational reasons. And the fact that we can find some examples where it doesn't really make sense doesn't bring down the law. And that's the essence of rational basis review, because any statute that makes a distinction is subject to it. And so if you imposed a higher burden, you'd basically be subjecting all laws to second guessing based on the idea that if I can find some examples where it may not make sense, the NASCAR driver who doesn't need a speed limit because he's a very good driver, he or she, I should say. I mean, we can find examples, but speed limits are legal. So that is what I would say in response to that. And I do think the Fifth Circuit's case from, what is it, Big Time Investments is on all fours and does an excellent job explaining why the Louisiana rule, which is effectively it works the same way. It's a revenue-based distinction between restaurants and bars. And the Fifth Circuit's rejects the plaintiff's argument that the order was irrational because some bars were permitted to operate, noting that, quote, imperfect classifications that are under-inclusive or over-inclusive pass constitutional muster, end quote. That's on page 470. And so I think that that's very good authority and explains exactly why Executive Order GA 28, 30, and 32 are rational.
I just want to ask you a question. Since we're not going into the merits, obviously, here. And again, putting the mootness issue aside, why can't the appellants not, as they put in their brief, challenge the meaning and extent of the governor's executive orders, and more importantly, the TABC's creation of the rules themselves? That's the gist of what they're saying, is that the way the TABC went about this is wrong and is a problem, and the courts ought to be able to look at that Why can't we not do that?
Sorry. Couple of things. First of all, I believe that's a reference to a rule challenge under the Administrative Procedures Act, but the TABC didn't issue rules that enforced GA 28. GA 28 was law, force and effect of law. The rules that they passed made it easier for bars to qualify as restaurants and to qualify for drive through and pickup sales. You know, under state law at the time, a bar couldn't sell, you know, your margarita to go. That was prohibited by state law. But because of the way that these executive orders were structured, it allowed the TABC to pass some rules that increased ability to sell alcohol despite the prohibition on in-person visitation. And so,
right, but we shouldn't be looking at you know, whether they were good or not or valid or not. We're just looking at whether they should be allowed to proceed in challenging this method.
Well, Your Honor, in order to overcome sovereign immunity, the plaintiff needs to show that an actual violation of constitutional rights occurred. And this is a direct quote from the Texas Supreme Court. While it is true that sovereign immunity does not bar a suit to vindicate constitutional rights, immunity from suit is not waived if the constitutional claims are facially invalid. And then other courts have elaborated a little bit on that and said that mere labels that something's illegal does not control. The question is a factual one. And so there's not a procedural due process claim in this case. And I don't, of the claims, retroactivity, takings, substantive due process, equal protection, which we talked about at length, free assembly, none of those actually raise a challenge to the process. And the APA itself only allows challenges to rules that cause an injury that actually affect that basically injure the license holder. And so and I recognize I'm out of time. If it's alleged that the rule or its threatened application interferes with, impairs, or threatens to interfere with or impair a legal right or privilege of the plaintiff, and that didn't occur here. And I see I'm out of time. So for all these reasons, we ask the court to affirm the trial court's order holding that it lacked jurisdiction over the case.
Thank you, Mr. Dower. Mr. Norrod, you may proceed.
There we go. I appreciate the court's recognizing that this is not a merits-based analysis, right? Opposing counsel likes to try to win it on the merits at this level, but claim 7 in our petition seeks to enjoin enforcement of the Alcoholic Beverage Code, section 11.614. And we're challenging its constitutional basis because it denies due process. And we've made these allegations. If the TBC wants to say that it's protecting the public for safe issues, because that's the basis and foundation of its action, then it has to stick to that. If it wants to then turn around and say, oh, but we can allow, the governor can allow the food truck Kafka-esque regulation scheme to pretend that this is okay. Well, that looks and smells more like a legislative law. You know, that's the stakeholders coming in perhaps and saying, look, you're putting all these people out of business. Let us operate in some way. Okay, so we're not gonna start trying to balance things. But that's not what they're being cited for. They're not being cited for, and the TABC is not relying on some sort of law that says we've evaluated the various priorities and we're going to allow this, even though it's unsafe, so these people can make some money and not die, their business die. Well, okay, then you've put together a rule. You have a process. Use your process, come up with a rule. What you can't do is say, we don't have a rule, but we're going to shoehorn in all of our citations into you're threatening the public while then making exceptions for some people using something that clearly makes it more dangerous. It doesn't make it safer. Of all the things that we could do, could anybody say that the food truck operating in a parking lot is somehow safer or is safe than just somebody having a few drinks in a bar. And as I point out in our briefing, opposing counsel likes to always say that to assert and to make us all envision the Start Club from 1980s as though every club's like that, when in reality, most clubs look a lot more like Cheers and they're older folks. And so without getting into the merits and just saying, let's look at the jurisdictional argument. We have a right under the Territory Judgment Act to challenge these rules. That's all we're doing. And we think we've got a pretty good challenge. And it's not a matter of maybe repeating. We have actual examples. This has repeated before. And as we've all seen, if we're taking kind of judicial notice, we know that we're into the booster land of our vaccine world. And we may find that something does or does not work in the future. Does anybody think that the governor, if receiving a sufficient political pressure, is not going to make another change? Of course he will. Of course he will. And we know that has happened in the past. So just because the opposing counsel's argument seems to be he hasn't reversed himself at every opportunity, therefore it doesn't constitute a reasonable expectation that it could repeat. No, we've seen exactly that the governor acts politically, and he can do this again, and he will do this again if the political winds go a different direction.
Well, I think we also need to be cognizant that there are elections and governors can change and different political winds may take control and I don't think we're here to mind read Governor Abbott, you know, or what he's likely to do. But I do want you to address the Jacobson case and whether the standard set there is what we would have to sort of what lens we would have to look through when we're trying to decide, you know, the standard of review under the parameters of that case and the subsequent acceptance. You know, even though it's a very, very old case, it seems to have been quoted recently, you know, by the Fifth Circuit.
So right. Jacobson is the new case that everybody gets to opine on all across the land, including the Supreme Court recently. So I love the Jacobson case because a fuller discussion of it is very helpful. Jacobson had an actual law that was passed. And so that by itself separates Jacobson from all of this that's going out there. Justice Gorsuch in the Cuomo Church case had a great point in his concurrence. He said, look, the government entities keep walking up to us and saying, Jacobson says we can do whatever we want during a pandemic. That is not what that says, right? That was a state legislature that passed a law, and it did so with all the stakeholders present. So we aren't talking about administrative procedures and made in an emergency situation. We're talking about a law made with all the stakeholders having the opportunity in the legislative process, which the Administrative Procedures Act is supposed to emulate to the best that it can for in certain circumstances to cover these certain areas. So I like Jacobson for what it says. It says you get all of the stakeholders together. You pass a law. And when you do that, not surprisingly, you get a better result than whenever you have this top-down Kafka-esque. I keep using that word because it's so appropriate here, because these things don't make sense. But in Jacobson, you had an established fine that was reasonable. People could pay. You had exceptions that were allowed, and everybody understood that. You had a process. You had a vaccine that was 100 years old. And at the time, we had already been handling that smallpox vaccines in one form or another since the 1500s. So these were not situations where anybody was, and you weren't putting thousands of people out of work because they happen to have not have room or have room for a food truck. So I like Jacobson for its actual teaching and not for the glossed over I can do whatever I want interpretation that government entities like to assume that it gets. Justice Gorsuch pointed that out very well in that poem. I would applaud that. We may have actually, we put that in there somewhere. Maybe not. There have been a lot of these cases. So did I answer your question?
Somewhat, yes. Did you like the case? We're yes. In trouble.
Well, you're welcome to supply that case to the court if it's convenient.
I'll have to do that.
Counselor, but the other, the 51% of food versus revenue from liquor, that's been in place for a very long time to set parameters for, I guess, because that just rings something in my memory about how there this 51% rule has been used by the legislature and TABC historically, has it not? It wasn't just the line that they drew or they came up with during the pandemic.
Well, I will admit that they use the 51% rule because it's easy for them to enforce. But you know, bars go up to 60%, but the 51% is really only relevant for the gun, carrying a gun and in and out. And so they have this big, nice, light, bright, you know, sign of what it, so it's easy to regulate. And I understand the inclusion argument. We're all about that. I argue that all the time. And that's the kind of thing you do when you have when you're passing a law. But if you're gonna say these people shouldn't operate because it's unsafe, then you're going to have to say that's an unsafe issue. And so if you're going to say it's unsafe, then you have to stick that up to that argument. And you can't turn around and say, well, but we don't want people to go belly up, so we're going to allow them to operate unsafely. If you're going to allow some people to operate unsafely, then you should allow everybody to operate unsafely. As our pleadings talk about, Chris Pallone, operator of the Rail in Fort Worth, it's a multifaceted event venue. He has a bar, liquor license, but the TABC came in and interrupted a show where there was no alcohol. So what they said was, if you ever had a bar license, you can't do anything. You have to close completely. He can't have a church picnic. He can't have a concert where nobody's drinking. He can't do anything. And so it gets even more ridiculous because he was working with the TABC here locally to say that, hey, we're doing this. There's no alcohol here. So even though I have a bar license, a liquor license, I'm not using that. I'm allowing bands to do things that are not bar oriented. So it shut down a whole lot of things that shouldn't have shut down. We talk about that in our pleadings in a brief. So Your Honors, I appreciate your time. And I'm happy to answer any further questions. I'll submit the Cuomo case for your enjoyment. It's a delightful case. Thank you.
Thank you both, gentlemen. Appreciate the arguments. Very interesting case, and it will be under submission.